Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Lowy Institute this evening. My name is Leon Berkelmans. I am the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. It is our pleasure to have Martin Wolf here with us tonight for an in-conversation event. Martin Wolf is Associate Editor and Chief Economics Commentator at the Financial Times. He was awarded the Commander of the British Empire in 2000 for services to financial journalism. He was a member of the UK government's Independent Commission on Banking between 2010 and 2011. He is an honorary fellow of Nuffield College and Corpus Christi College, Oxford, and King's College, London. He has honorary doctorates from Nottingham University and the London School of Economics. His most recent book is The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Still Have to Learn from the Financial Crisis. After the event, we will have some copies of that for sale afterward, which I'm sure Martin will be very happy to sign. But Martin, I don't want to start talking about that book. I'll start with a different book that you wrote. In 2004, you wrote a book called Why Globalization Works. I'd characterize that book as a very strong technocratic defense of globalization, with some recognition that there were some tattered edges that we needed to look out for. Since that time, that was in 2004, seems like an age ago, we've had the global financial crisis and the euro crisis, which have elements of globalization attached to it, capital flows and power of financial corporations. And we've had inequality occupy a more prevalent place in the public debate, and there are elements of globalization in that as well. So my question to you is, would you write the same book again today?
I think the answer for that is must be no. It's almost inconceivable that one, well, maybe it's not true, but I think for a book which is about contemporary events and contemporary circumstances, are always, any such book is always to a significant degree bound by experience. So I'm not trying to defend myself, but if Adam Smith had written, which I've read, written The Wealth of Nations 60 years later, a lot of it would have actually looked like Das Kapital, I think, because the whole phenomenon of early capitalism of the 19th century type, he didn't see because it didn't happen. It didn't exist. His examples show that he didn't know what a machine-based society would look like. So the answer, obviously, is it would be completely different. The question that is more interesting is not whether it would be different, but whether I and how I would change fundamentally my conclusions. So this is what I would still say and what I wouldn't. So the basic argument of the book was that the core argument was creating immense opportunities for growth through trade, above all, and foreign direct investment. I emphasize those two for the developing world, of which the most obvious successes were in Asia. China was already obviously a dramatic example. But by then, in the early 2000s, it was clear that India, which I'd worked on in the 70s, had moved to a completely new rhythm of growth. And without globalization, I don't think either of these events would have been possible. The second point the book makes is that as a result of that growth, it was reasonably clear, interesting, the evidence since then has become stronger on this, that for the first time since the early 19th century, global inequality among households, very important, not among countries, among households, had started to diminish from an incredibly high level, unbelievably. We were in 1980 was sort of the apogee of that and the degree of inequality among households. As a result of the divergence of countries, in average incomes, had reached an incredibly high level, I mean unbelievably high level by 1980, after almost two centuries of divergence. And it was already clear by the late 90s, early 2000s, that that was beginning to reverse, largely because of the success of Asia. And that continues to be the case. All the evidence we have, Branko Milanovic has recently published an excellent book, and this is that that's continued, and if anything, got stronger since then. And I considered these two very powerful strong forces. The third point I made is that there was clearly a rising inequality in many countries around the world, including some of the developed countries. But I had a whole chapter in which I argued that countries had the, and it's all about the welfare state, continue to have the room, if they wanted to use it, to pursue policies that would ameliorate those effects. It was still possible to raise taxes. It was still possible to redistribute income. And I pointed in particular to the extraordinary success in that regard, which was clearly then, and it's clear since then, the case of a number of countries, noticeably Scandinavian countries, to do precisely that. Some of the most globalized economies in the world. And if we refuse to do that, that's because we decided not to. But that was a political choice. It wasn't necessary in globalization. And I would stand by every one of those points very strongly today. So what did I get wrong? I had a chapter on finance, which was clearly the most skeptical, because I'd written a lot of very critical commentary on the Asian financial crisis and the way it'd been dealt with. And that worried me a lot. So I was very, very clear in the book that opening the capital account was risky, opening the capital account to banks was particularly risky, and people should be very careful about it. But in 2002 and 2003, when I wrote it, I certainly didn't expect the complete dissolution of the Western financial system. And if I'd been aware that that was likely to happen, my view of the financial sector would have been even more skeptical, substantially more skeptical than it was. It would have required a whole new book, which then I went on to write, and twice actually, to deal with that. And I started on that very soon afterwards. I got more and more concerned about the global financial system in successive books. But even so, it was only after 2007 that I realized how severe that was. So that was the first thing. The second thing that I didn't realize is that a core theme of my book, and this is the last thing I'll make, the core theme of my book, which I still think is, because I'm thinking of writing another book in this area, is the most important point about the political order of a globalized world. The underlying institutional basis of a globalized world is created by, supported by, sustained by nation states, whether nation will put it to side, but states. The states are obviously local by definition. They're not global. They have local responsibilities to their own people, to look after their own people, and they're responsive to them. And nonetheless, and this is particularly true of the more important ones, the US has been the paradigm example, the EU as a whole another, is they are also the entities that sustain such global order as there is, economically and also in other ways. This creates a fundamental tension in running a global economic system, because they're not responsible for, nor are they equipped to deal with the world system as a whole. That is an absolutely core tension. I don't see any way of solving that problem, since I don't believe in global government, and I don't believe we can go back to 200 completely independent national economies, neither desirable or feasible. The problems created by that conflict between the nature of the evolving economic order and the nature of the political system that underpins it has clearly become much greater, both in terms of legitimacy and in terms of effectiveness. I believed in this book that the EU presented to some extent a model of how we might manage this. It's clearly turned out to be more problematic. But when I think about it afterwards, in those core points and in the difficulties that would emerge, I don't think I would change so much in the new book, except I would be much more pessimistic about our ability to manage it all, partly because of the way finance has evolved, and with it the global capitalist order, and partly because of the way politics has evolved. But the problem is, somebody would come along to me and then say, okay, you now recognize these difficulties. What's the answer? I think the answer is as difficult as I would have thought then, which is, how do you run a world in which we're all dependent on one another? We're trading, we're investing. That's not going to stop because the opportunities are so great and so beneficial. And yet we all depend on the functioning of national politics and polities, which are very different, with very different constituencies, very different sources of legitimacy. That's not a problem to be solved. It's an immense fundamental fact about the world system, which somehow we have to live with.
So you don't think the existing architecture, like the WTO, the G20, the IMF, are really up to the job?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, almost by definition, they're not up to the job, because they can't be, because these are systems of cooperation among states ultimately dependent on what states are prepared to give them, both the legitimacy and the power. And if states are unable to cooperate with another or to manage the internal stresses within them, you can see so visibly in the US elections at the moment, then those systems won't function. So to take the WTO, which I wrote a piece, I changed my mind on this, but I have always thought the Doha round was very unlikely to succeed. And it was an incredibly unlikely gamble, though I thought after 9/11 it was worth taking the gamble because one needed some statement that the global order was still sustainable. But the problems of the WTO have nothing to do with the problems of the WTO. The problems of the WTO are the problems of the member states of the WTO that just don't want to do any more of this. So in the trade area, my own personal view, which is very unpopular, I've written one column on these lines, is that we should declare victory and stop. I think all the trade agreements we're now involved in have very, very marginal gains and very large political costs that we should forget about because they're not important. So I'm sort of at the end of trade, and I've been more committed on the trade thing because trade has been an incredible success. But that's controversial because I think that's done. Finance, I have consistently argued now in the last 7 or 8 years, I was already starting that in the globalization book, but I've gone further, that in very important ways, finance has to be deglobalized. I think that can be done in a sensible way. That was part of what our Independent Commission on Banking actually proposed. We proposed deglobalization. It was the consensus of our group, and people haven't commented on that fact. And the reason for that is we don't have a global regulatory structure for finance, and we're not going to have one. We have a set of national regulators. We can agree on rules, but the regulations and the ultimate responsibility for a financial system rests with national governments because the taxpayers bear and will always bear some of the risk in the system. As long as we have anything like our current financial system, we can come later to having a completely different one, but as long as we have anything like our current system. So a fully globalized banking system is a very problematic entity, so we might well have to deglobalize. There are other areas when it's pretty obvious compared with 2003-04, my views in 2002. So my biggest criticism of myself in writing a book in 2002 is I have almost nothing about the environment, which I think was quite scandalous and outrageous. And it was only subsequently that I, in the succeeding 2 or 3, 4 years, that I really started thinking seriously about global commons problems, like the climate system. And so now I would say global commons problems and global security problems, it broadly defined, which includes migration problems, are much bigger and more important challenges for our limited capacity to cooperate globally than the trade and finance area, where I would be quite happy with a measure of deglobalization. But the fundamental dilemmas of running a global world in which we share a planet, we share massive interests collectively, but we're ultimately governed by 200 different countries, a vast, that was a central theme of the book, and I still think it's one of the most important themes of the book.
Are you optimistic in our ability to deal with the climate change problem?
No, I'm absolutely clear that we have decided not to deal with it. That we have looked it squarely in the face and decided the best thing to do with this very difficult problem is to pretend we're going to do something about it. So it's what was the famous line about communism? You pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. So in this case, we are pretending to deal with the climate system and the world will proceed as if we're not pretending.
Are you optimistic about our abilities to deglobalize finance, in your words?
Some aspects of finance have been, to a not insignificant degree, deglobalized. Sort of willy-nilly. And other aspects have been, I think, quite significantly curtailed. There are quite a number of countries. It's happened in the US to a lesser degree, but it's happened very much in the UK, and there is some sign it's happening in Europe, which have pursued the policy we pursued, which was essentially to separate out and subsidiarize on a really as freestanding separate entities, retail banks. So our retail banks are in essence British-only institutions. their ability to do, by law, they're entitled to do lots of business in Europe by branching, but in practice they don't do that much. So retail banking in Britain is deglobalized to a very significant degree. Furthermore, it is to a very significant degree separated off from investment banking, and the use of retail banking funding to support investment banking has been made more difficult. The purpose of that was to close down, to make it more difficult to mix government-backed funding with the investment banking industry, and the consequence is quite obvious, which is, in my view, we're going to end up with only one bank which has a significant investment banking presence, and that's HSBC, which is a sui generis bank. So the two main objectives, which were, and the finally, we, along with everyone, and here we, Britain played a very big part in this, very big part, decisive. We have pushed up capital requirements in banking quite a lot. Not as much as I would like, but then I'm an ultra radical on this, but quite a lot. And that's killed an awful lot of investment banking. So the effect is that the investment banking business is shrinking and will continue to shrink in my judgment. And concentrate more and more in a limited number of global American institutions, defined by me. They can bear the risk. America has the fisc to do so. You know, one of the great shocks in the banking story, I didn't know this. These are things one should have known, but I didn't. But in 2007, the British banking system's balance sheets were as big as those of the entire American banking system. I wonder how many people here knew that. The British banking system's balance sheets were as big as the entire American banking system. And the result was their banking balance sheets were one times GDP and ours were 5.5 times. They could afford it, we couldn't. And so we tried to end this. The result at the end is that the Americans will dominate the investment banking unless the Chinese are foolish enough to try and compete in it. But we are out of this and all the others are. So I would say, we have had a fairly significant, not what I would like, but fairly significant progress in deglobalizing finance and particularly cross-bank border bank funding, which has been the Achilles heel of finance in most crises. Hitherto, very much in the Asian crisis, it was the cross-border banking that killed them. And I think we've made some progress in reducing that absurd sort of funding of long-term investment positions.
Earlier, you mentioned Branko Milanovic's book, which you wrote a review of a few weeks ago. You called it an outstanding book, and I agree. I think it was great. You mentioned it focused on global inequality, but there was a discussion in the book about national inequality, inequality within borders. Yeah. And he talked a lot about the political process and how there are forces that are there that keep inequality quite high. And you wrote this: if ever-rising inequality within countries is to be avoided, redistribution of the income from capital or of wealth seems to be an inescapable part of the answer. Is this politically possible? Probably not. In which case, the political future of the West looks bleak. So you weren't optimistic before about some other things. It looks like you're not optimistic about the political future of the West. Full stop. Could you expand on those thoughts a little bit more?
Well, why have I become more pessimistic? I'm planning at the moment, it's very early stage, a book on the future of what I call democratic capitalism. As I said in my early book on globalization, I argued that we had the capacity within developed countries, because we have very well-developed fiscal and other systems, to manage the consequences of globalization. We could manage them. And some countries have shown that it could be done. But on the whole, we've not been very willing to do so. It's become increasingly clear that the political forces, as they've evolved, have made it more difficult to pursue these policies, the policies that I thought were desirable in terms of redistribution and in terms of support for the losers, which is the essence of it. Second, it's become obvious that there are significant losers. In relative terms, in absolute terms, not so clear. That's a huge debate, but certainly in relative terms, in many countries, there are relative losers. Third, it's clear that the combination of what they see as the sources of their losses, which are more complicated than this, immigration and trade, are identified by them as things that need to be stopped. And in the absence of any alternative policies, they're going to find the sort of policies we're seeing being proposed by Mr. Trump, by UKIP in the UK, to a lesser degree by Marine Le Pen, very attractive. And mainstream politicians, certainly in the countries I know about, I can't talk about Australia, which is obviously sui generis in its economics in many ways as a resource exporting country. But there are mainstream politicians found it very difficult to respond to this very effectively and have lost legitimacy as a result. Now, I don't think that was completely inevitable, but it was likely. And it's gone furthest in the US, which is the most important country by far for the West, if there is a West. Without the US, it doesn't exist. So it's clear that we haven't done very well in managing that side, the impact on our job markets of technological change, which I haven't discussed, which was an essential part of that book, which is, I think, probably more important. The change in the role of finance, which I think we might be beginning to reverse through natural processes, but that was important, and globalization. We haven't handled that very well. And then over and above that, and this is an essential part of my last book, and it's indeed how the last book ends, clearly the financial crisis itself, the way it had to be handled, I think, once it emerged, was a devastating blow to the credibility and legitimacy of the policy making and financial and economic establishment. I describe in the end of my last book this is sort of what I see in a very complicated society governed by extreme division of labor, which is inevitable. There's a sort of tacit deal. It's never between the majority of the people trying to lead their lives in a decent way and the people who seem to be in charge of our institutions, that the latter can sort of run things, will vote from time to time, and whether it's tolerable or not, broadly, among people who are competing in this sphere. But the deal is, in turn, certainly in the democratic West, in return, you run things well enough for us to have prosperous lives and continue to see better opportunities for our children. That's the deal. Well, the financial crisis blew this out of the water completely. It was a devastating, unexpected shock. It has led to years of low growth. Most economies have not, the UK, real standards of living have only just returned to pre-crisis levels. So people have lost confidence in the elites. So we've got these two problems, these long-term shifts in income, wealth, as I said, not just globalization, technology is clearly important, role of financial sector and all the rest of it, the way corporate governance has gone, another issue that I've become increasingly interested in, and then this huge financial shock. So we need to restore the legitimacy of democratic governance in our societies, which has clearly been shaken very, very seriously, and we are seeing signs of that very clearly across Europe and America.
With the growth of China and India over the last 20 or 30 years, I think the idea that economic convergence is a strong force has gained more traction. I think in the 1990s, people didn't think convergence was a very strong force. Yeah. Now with China and India, that seems to have reversed a little bit. Now as China's growth slows, you may start to see people reappraise that judgment. What's your take on it? Is convergence a strong force in the global economy? And what does that mean for the future?
It's a fantastically important question for the future. And then now I can see that for the developed countries, it's rather double-edged, but leaves that aside for the moment. Well, first of all, in talking about the reduction in inequality among households across the world, the main driving force was simply the convergence of average incomes, which means no more than the fact that GDP per head, the average, in many important or in a number of very important big emerging countries, was much faster than in the West for a long period. And that was the convergence. So to take the most remarkable case of all, which is essentially the most remarkable case in history, China, there's only one comparable case, which is South Korea. And it's since it's, 25th the size? Somebody will correct me, something like that. It's something like that. Actually, I think it's more a 30th. It's not really comparable. So if you take the standard numbers on real incomes per head, back in 1978, at the time the reform started in China, real incomes per head in China which, remember, had been probably the most advanced country in the world 1,000 years ago. I won't get into the precise timing, it's a very controversial one, but about the Song era, was 3% of US levels, 3%. And India was a little more, but basically 3 or 4%. And in the most recent IMF numbers, it's about 25%. That's a pretty staggering change in the generation. In India, it's moved from about 3% to about 10%. Those are incredibly rapid relative changes, which clearly indicate that these two enormous countries, which contain, after all, now, is it, what, about 2.5 billion people now, which is 2.5 times the entire industrialized world, have been converging over a long period and consistently. And at the current growth rates, China and India are continuing to do so at a fair rate. Another very large Asian country, which has done the same thing, there are quite a number of smaller ones, which has done the same thing, not as dramatically, but actually over the last 35, 40 years, most people don't realize this, has also converged, not so dramatically, but significantly, is Indonesia. So those are important, dramatic successes. There are also important and dramatic failures. So this is, gets your rule. So I have a chart which I often use, in which I look at the 7 largest emerging countries in the world, as they're now defined, in terms of relative GDP per head to the West since the mid-90s. And the other 4, for your interest, I hope I can remember that, are Brazil, Mexico, Turkey, and Russia. Russia is a bit controversial, having it. Now, the interesting thing about those group is Brazil and Mexico have converged not one jot or iota in the last 40 years. Nothing. Zero. And that's true basically of everywhere in Latin America except Chile, which is very, very small. There's no relative change. They haven't got worse, but, well, Argentina's got worse, but the others. The Middle East, essentially nothing, except the oil exporters. That's not, I'm just putting those in. Turkey actually had a very, very good period from about 2000 to 2010, 11, but Erdogan is killing it. Clearly killing it. So it looks like being a 10-year wonder. And that's consistent with Turkey's past. They've been up and down, but there's not been a very strong convergence. It's a very important country. And Russia, the same process. It was mostly oil. So if you look at these 7 large countries, you've got the 3 I mentioned, which are the most important, and the others are really not achieving anything. If you look at it globally, more widely, there are quite a number of small countries. I mentioned Chile, Malaysia, Thailand had a long period, which have converged to some degree. So what I would say is the evidence shows, 1, it is possible to converge. Big and very important countries have converged consistently and are continuing to do so. And it is perfectly possible to remain exactly where you were indefinitely. And which of these tendencies will win seems to me to be the result of choices made by the countries themselves and by and the way the international environment evolves. And it would be impossible to argue that convergence is certain to happen in general. I haven't talked about Africa, special problems, or that it is inconceivable. All we can say is there have been successes. If, however, this is my very last word, China and India were to continue at their sort of current rate, so China's GDP per head rising about 4%, 5% a year, India similarly, for another 20 years. Not inconceivable. Okay? Optimistic, not inconceivable. We're going to live in a completely and utterly different world.
Is it harder to catch up now, do you think? So
yes.
Why do you think it's harder
to catch
up?
Because it seems to me that technology, look, now this is an area I'm not an expert on, so and there's a lot of work going on this, but the great, it's clear that India is a bit of an exception, but the most successful catch-up countries in the post-war period have been countries that evolved out of exports of labor-intensive manufacturers. They derived the beginning from the exports of labor-intensive manufacturers. They generated very high savings. They invested a lot in infrastructure and in education. They improved the quality of their labor force, moved up the ladder of comparative advantage very quickly. That's very much the Japanese, Korean, Taiwanese, and Chinese pattern, that obviously on an enormous scale. India is slightly different, and it's also partly by why it's been a bit slower. But India has the great advantage if they have managed their affairs. They managed an IT-based export. It's so big, they have potentially a very large domestic market they can drive off if they manage it reasonably well. I think pursuing the labor-intensive manufacturing route looks to me as though it's become significantly more difficult and will continue to become significantly more difficult because technology is undermining the value of cheap labor. And if that is true, then that pattern of development won't work. There will have to be something else. And I'm not suggesting it's impossible. But if you look at other sorts of developments, I mean, it's tourist-led development. Lots of countries have tourist opportunities. But very few countries that I can think of have managed a tourist-led development. Another example of a country actually the most successful in Africa, if it's in Africa, is a bit controversial issue, which also started the labor-intensive manufacture routes, but it's very small, is Mauritius. And they moved all up the level. So I'm wondering whether this can be continued. It's also important to stress, actually there is a country that I should have mentioned, which I think has a very, very good chance. I should have mentioned, ridiculous. It wasn't in my list of seven because it was still such a small economy, but which I think is the most likely to replicate is Vietnam. So that might well be possible. But I think it's not clear that the labor-intensive manufacturers route is one that is going to work for all the other countries. And lots of them, in any case, don't have really a comparative advantage in this area. How successful, how you build, a lot of the countries left have very big problems. How you build a successful development program for the very large number of landlocked African countries, for example, pretty difficult problem.
So to change tack a little bit, let's talk about Brexit.
That is different.
So in Australia, I think it's fair to say the Brexit debate isn't really getting much airtime. We're not paying all that much attention. Should we pay more attention?
Well, I think it shows that one would have expected that the relationship between Britain and Australia has matured, which is another way of saying you are properly indifferent to the fate of the old mother country, and that is maturity. Australia is now fully grown up. And is not too concerned about the idiocies of an aged and rattled parent. I would argue that for Australia, Brexit is, I was discussing a second or third order issue. Clearly I can think of much more important issues, the state of the whole world economy, the relationship, the dynamism of the Chinese economy, the relationships between the US and China, and the role of the United States as a world power. So if, for example, the US decides that actually it's no longer interested in the world, that's, I would have thought, pretty fundamental for Australia. So those here are, off the top of my head, four issues that must be much more important than Brexit. I happen to think that if we fry the planet, you're not going to like it here either, but that's you seem to have different views. So,
this is winter. This weather's winter.
Exactly. Yeah. But I do think there is something significant at stake here, even for you. Europe continues to be a very important part of the world economy. It's roughly as big as the US. Not dynamic. It's not going to be dynamic again. That's clearly true, but it is still a big part. It's a very big part of the West, not as important as the US. It's a very big part of the West. I think that it is plausible, though not certain, that if the UK leaves, it will destabilize the European structure to some extent. It will certainly make it more inward looking. I think it will weaken the West to some degree, particularly when isolationism is becoming stronger in the US. And it will leave the UK sort of free floating and not quite knowing at all what it's about. As a result, I think the West as a whole will be weakened. How significantly is difficult to tell. And for the reasons we've already discussed, the position of the West in the world is in decline, relatively, no doubt about it. If it fractures in this way, it will go more into decline. And I would argue that Australia remains, I'm going to say something very controversial, an outpost of Western civilization an environment which isn't Western. So if the West becomes a weakened, fractured, in more ineffective entity, Australia becomes more strategically and possibly more economically exposed than it is. I wouldn't stress the second, but I would stress the first. And therefore, if an Australian, I would say this anyway, think that it would be nicer if the British decided, I know when we went in, it was a terrible shock. It was a betrayal, seen as a betrayal, which it was. By the way, but I think it was the right thing for Britain to do then, and I think it was very good for Australia that we did, because it forced you to grow up, as we discussed. And now you can look at it with some indifference. But I think that if I were an Australian, I wouldn't consider it anything close to the top issue in my agenda. It's not something I would pore over a paper for passionately, you know, the newspaper every morning to see what happened. But I would feel, if Britain decides to leave, I would feel some mild regret.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to open it up for questions in a few moments, so get your questions ready. I'm going to play a little game here with Martin that I'm going to rip off from Tyler Cowen's podcasts, if you've listened to those. It's called Undervalued or Overvalued. I'm going to mention a concept, a thing, a place, and Martin's going to tell me whether it's undervalued, overvalued, or fairly valued. So whether you want to go long or short.
Okay, long, short.
Long, short. So let's start with the EU.
Short.
Short, all right. If you want to give us a little explanation as well, you don't have to.
Well, if you want me to explain it all. I think the economy is in trouble. They've created the euro, which is dysfunctional, as I always thought it was. So there are some things I did get right at the time, even in the early 90s. And the fissiparous tendencies are very, very great. And it's not quite clear how they're going to keep this show together. And I didn't discuss the migration crisis. So very much short. Yes, alas.
Somewhat related, Germany.
I'd go short. Just, yeah. Relative to current views of Germany.
Yes, yeah, well, it's relative to the market. Yeah. That's what
relative. The market relative thinks the market. Germany is all powerful. So right. I think it's overboard.
Newspapers.
Except for the Financial Times. I'd go, there's a reason for this. I will explain. I'd go short on a lot of them. We've moved into a world in which the traditional basis for... I'm going to leave aside the tabloid press, about which I know nothing and I don't read. So I don't care. That's a different business. But if you look at what we might call broadly, used to be the broadsheet business, the quality newspaper business, at least in Britain and America, I don't know the state here, the core revenue model for all of us was completely bound up with advertising. The FT was an advertising platform. Once you leave, that has gone for good and it's gone. And that has led to revenue collapse. The only alternative model anybody has yet found is to find people who are willing to pay for the content. And the only people who are prepared to pay for the content are people with lots of money who see what you're producing as business relevant. And that basically means us and the journal. And I think for all the other broadsheets, it's a fantastically difficult to design a revenue-generating business model that works, and nobody has. We have succeeded. I think we're probably the only major broadsheet in the world. Throughout the last 15 years, we have never lost money in any year. I don't think there's any other of which that's true. We've not made much, let me be very, very clear, and we're very lean, but we can, and we have made a transition almost completely to subscriptions. The moment is nightmare. Advertising is collapsing. So the answer is, this is a very, very difficult business to operate. But the only good thing from our point of view is that most of the new rivals who are producers of content are failing too. Making money out of producing content is very, very hard, which is why I've sometimes said the internet's great genius is to produce and disseminate absolutely no information whatsoever for free.
All right.
Prejudice, anger, rage, drivel. This is why, in my view, this is why I wrote this column. In this world, a public service broadcaster like the BBC has turned out to be more valuable, not less so.
Is this why you don't have a Twitter account?
I have decided to have a very distant relationship with the new media. And first of all, I think I really think Twitter is fundamentally evil. Anybody who's interested in what can be produced in how many of these characters, like this is not somebody I want to have read anything I write. But I think there's a more important point. I really think it's dangerous because for somebody like me, and I suspect it might be true of many others, it is just so irresistibly tempting, faced with an asinine tweet from somebody, to respond, and then everybody in the world will see the drivel that you've just produced in a moment of white heat of rage, and you succeed in destroying a reputation you painfully built up over a lifetime. So my view, for me, has no upside and nothing but downside, and quite apart from that I despise the entire concept. And I have the same relationship to Facebook, and as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see, they are destroying our civilization.
Short on Twitter.
Although I'm told, actually, which cheers me up a great deal, I don't know why, because I know nothing about it, that the business is doing very, very badly. And I've been told that. I read about it. I don't know why it's doing very badly, but I hope it's short, but I don't have a strong view on it. But my view is it would be senseless for me to get involved in it.
Finally, one more thing, if everyone will just indulge me. Tell me something that's true that very few people agree with you about.
Oh my God, I'll have to think about that. Something that's true that very few people agree with me about.
I stole this one from Tyler Cowen as well.
Did you?
I did, yes.
Something that's true that very few people agree with me about. Well, probably the most controversial view I hold. I don't know how many people. I don't know whether I could say it's true because it's an argument, but I believe it's true, which is that we could eliminate banking altogether. It's a very, very stupid idea, and it's no longer necessary, and we should close it down.
And he does mention that in his book, actually, so another reason to buy it. So I will throw it open to the audience now. Could you please say your name and your affiliation? And I find good questions have two features. One, they are short, and two, they end with a question mark. So if you could adhere to those rules, that would be wonderful. So who's first?
Thanks very much. Christopher Flynn, I'm a partner at Gilbert and Tobin, one of the major law firms here in Sydney. When you were asked the question about Brexit and where you would see it, or where one might see it if they're an Australian, on Brexit, you said, you mentioned that Brexit might leave Australia strategically exposed, I think were your words, and you made a separate point about economics. Can you explain what you meant exactly or roughly when you use the word strategic? What sort of exposure are you referring to?
All I meant is that if it becomes part, it will be a small element in the disintegration of the West as a system, to the extent it is, and to the extent that Australia is part of that, then it leaves, that's all I meant, that it leaves Australia more strategically exposed. Of course, far more important is the future of the US on its own. And it might well be that for the US, the further decay of Europe will just lead to a fundamental strategic realignment towards Asia. The net effect might be positive for you, but it would leave the US without quite significant economic support in many of the things it's been involved in, trade and so forth, from Europe. So that's what I meant. But I think these are things that are highly uncertain. But that's what I had in mind.
Mark Wills from State Street. Russia, is it a buy or a sell?
I think it's a sell. Russia is a country with a declining population, which has a dysfunctional economy. It has fundamentally failed in the last 25 years to make the transition to a post-communist functioning market system, very dependent on commodities, which continue to be very valuable, but they are what they are, and they're not going to increase in value much. The evidence I see is, even depending, for example, on the oil and gas, that they're not going to, anything's possible, I don't know, but they're not likely to increase production significantly. And the value of that commodities depends obviously on the future of oil prices, I can't comment on. But it doesn't look as though now at all likely that Russia is going to be more than an oil producer with rockets. It has a large, but not omnipotent, I mean, there's a sizable military and obviously the capacity to blow up the world, but that itself doesn't make me want to buy it. And it has huge empty areas right next to a rising China and resources that China wants. And I think, given that it has decided to become fundamentally hostile to the West, that it will ineluctably decline into being a Chinese satellite. By the way, what I've just said is what a number of my most intelligent Russian friends think, quietly. They obviously don't say this. So in the long term, unless something very fundamental changes, and I think Putin has established a regime here, though it's personal, I suspect it's clear now that the sort of transition some of us hoped for after communism, no doubt naively, is not going to happen. I would consider Russia in its current strategic conjuncture, and economic conjuncture, it's a middle-income country, you know, its economy is smaller than Italy's. I don't think this is a buy.
Fred Woollard, you've express the view that banks globally should increase their capital ratios. Is that a view, in your experience, shared by policymakers in major countries? And is it sufficiently strongly held that they can override the banking lobby, who obviously don't want that?
I think where we've got to is the new equilibrium, to answer your question. So the consensus of policymakers who mattered was that the capital should be substantially greater than it was when we went into the crisis. Since that was effectively zero, that wasn't difficult to agree. The leverage ratios for the major Western banks that I know of were between 30 and 50 to 1. So that isn't much equity. And it's clearly increased very substantially there, to at least not much more than 20 to 1, depends on how you define the capital. And I'm not going to go into all the instruments and so forth. So the shock was big enough and the regulators were frightened enough to insist on increasing the capital at least two or three times relative to assets and on some definitions by more, depends on how you measure it. And so that is a significant increase, but it is clear that there wasn't enough will to go much beyond that. So I would say that's a real improvement, but not an adequate one. Now, they also decided, and this was, I don't want to get into the details of this, is a very big issue to continue, and there were intellectual reasons for that, but I just don't agree with them, with the risk weighting structure in determining how much capital was needed. I am very, very deeply convinced that the risk weighting process is almost impossible to make work. And so I just like straight equity. But so the answer is we have significantly de-risked the banking system relative to where it was in 2007, in my view, globally. But my view is also it's not enough in the sense that this is where we are now at the end of a huge healing process. And the next boom will probably see enormous pressure to let the capital float down, and we will be told it'll happen 10, 20 years from now that things are much safer and we're much better managed and all the rest of it. This time is different, and therefore we could get back there pretty quickly. It is important, I'm not saying that that will happen, but many people don't know this, that the leverage of the major Western banks doubled in 4 years before the crisis. That's an amazingly quick destruction of balance sheets. So you do have to watch them like hawks. And they are very, very clever. And there are many ways of concealing leverage. I mean, one of the ways, for example, they were told they had all sorts of, you know, all the sieves and conduits, which were created off balance sheet in order to, and they were notionally off balance sheet, so they were allowed to be off balance sheet. There were ways of holding risk assets, which they got pension funds and others to invest in, and German lender and all the rest of it. They were off balance sheet, and the Fed, which is a great institution, accepted this, and so they were off balance sheet. The leverage didn't appear until, of course, things started to fold, collapse, and they all had to pull them right back onto the balance sheet because they couldn't, in fact, disown them. So there are so many ways to conceal leverage in a boom. So as I said, it's not enough, but we moved in a slightly better direction, and it is all that the bank, that the governments are willing to do, because the bankers will tell them that if you insist that we have what would be regarded in any other business as a reasonable level of equity, we can't make any money, we won't support the growth of your economy, which they don't anyway, and the world will end. And that argument has worked pretty well, and they're very determined and very successful and very potent lobbyists. So that's the new equilibrium. I regard it as an improvement, but nowhere near enough, and I hope that in the next crisis, which will happen, we'll do better.
Frank McIndoe from JB Weir. Would you see the apparent decline in global productivity as a combination or one of measurement problems, incentive structure problems, a cyclical issue, or do you see it as something structural?
I think that's the biggest question in economics now. And I think the best answer to this question, like all really interesting questions, is we don't know. But I think we know a little. So let's first be clear what's happened. Since the crisis, to some extent, it was clear already before the crisis, the rate of productivity growth, labor productivity, and so-called total factor productivity growth in Western economies has declined significantly. It's happened in different economies at different points, which is itself very interesting. So I'll just look at the G7 for a moment because it's part of the puzzle. Italy has basically stopped having productivity growth in the late 1990s. Altogether, Italy hasn't had any productivity growth for nearly 20 years. The UK has had very, very buoyant productivity growth till 2007, and none since then. Nearly none, which is extraordinary. The US, Germany, France are more similar. They've all had moderate productivity growth. The US was better, and it's all declined since the crisis, but it's been positive. Sort of 1 to 0.5% to 1%. But even the US, it's 1%. Labor productivity growth in the US is 1%. And that means potential growth, as measured, in the developed world, if we're optimistic, is somewhere around 1.75% for the US and about 1.25% for Europe, which is much lower than historical levels. And now it's partly because of demography. When I saw the potential growth, because of course the baby boomers, which we all had baby boomers, as it were, after the Second World War, are retiring, so that the labor force either is in Germany and Japan. I haven't met Japan is in Germany and Japan. The labor Germany is a bit separate because of the migration there. Japan, the labor force is shrinking. In Italy, the labor force is shrinking, and in America, it's still growing, but much more slowly. So productivity becomes more important in that environment because the demography is working against you. So what is going on? What is driving this? I think there is reasonable reason to believe there is a measurement problem, but there's been a lot of really quite careful work on this recently. Charlie Bean, who used to be the deputy governor of the Bank of England, has just done a big examination of our statistics. The Americans have done quite sophisticated work at the Council of Economic Advisers, and the measurement problem can't explain the decline of this large decline in just a few years. As I said in the British case, you know, the ONS is probably incompetent in 2006, and it was incompetent in 2009, but it didn't get suddenly so much more incompetent, and our economy didn't change so profoundly in those 3 years, because it really didn't, that to explain this immense collapse. So the measurement is there. But the second point I'd make about measurement, we've been underestimating productivity growth forever. There's lots of work which makes clear that productivity growth has been underestimated by statistical offices and therefore price increases have been overestimated for centuries or more. Nordhaus's famous work on the price of light brought that out. So I don't think the measurement thing gets you very far. It's something. There's another argument, which is quite different from the GDP, and I'll just deal with it because it's very important, which is we've got lots of welfare increases which aren't in the GDP because they're just not being, they're not things that anybody's paying for. So as somebody pointed, GDP, in GDP terms, Google is an advertising agency. In GDP terms, search is free. Not part of GDP. But there's always been lots of unmeasured value. The economy generates lots of unmeasured value. And whether this is more than it used to be, I think it's really difficult. I tend to the view that the big revolution, for instance, in the productivity of our homes, an immense unmeasured value, productivity of home production, generated by electric light and clean water, my God, and washing machines and refrigerators. It was also unmeasured. And I think the refrigerator is slightly more important than the iPad. And I'm putting it gently. So that doesn't get you very far. So I actually think something bigger is going on. And I would suggest there are two things which are relevant to thinking about what might be going. Three things. One, the crisis, and this is clear, the crisis had a devastating effect on investment everywhere. We've had very weak investment in the major economies since the crisis. And one big driver of technological change is investment. So capital accumulation has been very low. That might return. So that could be temporary. If and when we restore growth, capital investment will improve. That might be positive. It's just temporary. And it might be related, second, to the fact that we've had very, very weak demand for a very long time. And if you've got very weak demand, economy firms say, well, why should I spend a lot on capital, obviously, but also why should I really be innovating and investing? There's no market here. It depresses animal spirits. Some of that seemed to have happened in the 30s, so that's a controversial issue. So there's the demand issue. Could we do better if we had more buoyant demand? Incentives have clearly not radically deteriorated. I mean, in general, tax systems have become, over time, in the last 20, 30 years, more favorable to upper incomes. Top rates have declined. Very difficult to argue there's been a very significant increase in the regulatory burden over this period, except possibly in the environment. Labour markets have generally been deregulated, more than regulated, in the main economy. So I don't think that's a big factor. So what you're left with here is the two most, I think, important facts, which are that the area where we're seeing, this is the Robert Gordon argument, which I'm very sympathetic with, which is that the main revolution we're now seeing is in fairly arcane, well, parts of the information technology area, and it just isn't that revolutionary for the economy as a whole. Don't forget, we've been in the computer age for 60 years, and a lot of the really big change on the economy occurred a long time ago. We tend to, because we take them for granted, but I'm old enough to remember when the mainframe changed pretty well how accounting systems worked in every bank and every business. That was a tremendous productivity revolution. Well, by comparison, it's not clear the smartphone is that big a deal. So I think the internet is an old technology now. The big impact of the internet had a big impact on productivity between 1995 and 2004-5. But it doesn't look at the margin it's having that big effect. So it's actually this technology stuff is overhyped stuff. I happen to believe that's true, compared with previous revolutions. And the other fact, and this is the thing I would like to leave you with most, is you have to think about the structure of our economies. And why it's difficult to raise productivity seems to me pretty obvious. A very simple reason, which is almost by definition, the bits where it was really, really easy to raise productivity have become very small. And the bits we're left with are the bits, by definition, that are really hard to raise productivity in. So agriculture, you could quadruple the productivity in our agriculture, and we wouldn't need, it's an error term, because we got 0.5% of the labor force in agriculture. We've now got about 11 or 12% of the labor force in manufacturing. We could quadruple the productivity in manufacturing. It's quite likely we will in the next 30, 40 years. In the aggregate economy, it's quite a small deal, because manufacturing is small and cheap. It's not a big part of our economy. So what do we do? Well, there's a fair amount of high quality price services which might be vulnerable to technology. So I think some of you are lawyers. Well, maybe you're going to be replaced by computers. And that could be quite a big deal. There are a few management consultants I'd like to see replaced by computers. But that, you know, that side, financial transactions, yes. But the things we really have, huge sectors of our economies now, are education, the health system, tourism, really big employers of people, transport services, some of that could change. These are really difficult things to change radically productivity in. It still requires lots of human labor to do all these things. And if you look at the growing demand in the future for looking after all of people like me when we're all senile, there are lots of us, and children, processing all this, we use people. And we don't know how to make these people much more productive. A lot of them, of course, but by no means all, are also employed by governments, which are particularly resistant. And that's 80% of the economy. Right? And so I think we've ended up, the reason we're finding it so difficult to raise productivity is, this is my theory anyway, and I think it's basically borne out, is that we have moved progressively to a situation in which what's left is really hard to raise productivity in. And I don't think you're going to be very happy with leaving all your parents or yourselves or your children in school being taught by, looked after robots. That's not what's going to happen. And that means we might be getting quite naturally to the point at which productivity is not what it's about. But you could also take the view, well, we're fantastically rich. The manufacturing products are going to become like agricultural products. They'll be essentially free. Lots of manufacturers are to people in this sort of society now. You think about what a car used to cost in terms of hours of work and months of work compared to now. And everything else remains expensive. And so the great growth process, this is Robert Gordon's great point, the great growth process is over. Let me say, I know this is a long answer, but it's something that I care about a lot. There is, of course, the possibility that incredibly exciting technological changes, which are not relevant to productivity in an obvious sense, could happen. It may be true that they're going to create artificial intelligence that is much, much smarter than all of us. It's going to be really quite a big deal. I don't really care what it does to the economy. It changes everything. And the other possibility, well, maybe they will really succeed in making us all live, or our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren, for 300 or 400 years. That's a big deal too. I think it's a nightmare, but I think it's a... So there are things that could happen which we shouldn't judge in economic terms, which are incredibly big. But the unproductive system might possibly have got to the point where it's really just hard to raise productivity for the economy as a whole because of what it looks like.
Well, thank you very much. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Martin. Unfortunately, we've come to the end. I've got plenty more questions. You probably have plenty more questions, but we must finish now. Thank you all very much for coming. Let's give Martin a round of applause.